So, we're going to continue from last week. And last week, we talked about a lot of things. We did a lot of reviewing, but we came to a point in the history of ISKCON in which we had talked about faith. A lot of faith was broken when a lot of the original gurus had trouble. Yeah, they actually either left Krishna consciousness or weren't able to follow all the principles, which was a huge shock because nobody could believe that. You want to put that over there so it won't be in front of everyone? Which nobody could believe in their wildest dreams, imagination, that that would ever happen. And it, like, as an American, we know as an American, and this is probably has affected all the whole world. American economy was very good, and then in 2008 hit probably its lowest point ever. And it was like the all-powerful America was on the verge of going bankrupt, which would affect the whole world. So it was something like that. How could you imagine America, money not being worth anything, right? So nobody could imagine that these people would have difficulty. So it sent shockwaves in the form of loss of faith. And as I said last week, it wasn't only the faith of disciples, the faith of other disciples. They were losing faith in their guru. Because, you know, just like if you're married and all your friends, their husbands cheat on them, you're going to start worrying about your husband. And you might be upset with him for no reason. Right? So it was like that. That was the effect it was having on disciples, but it was also having an effect on God brothers. Because they had to work with these people, and they were giving everything to these people, and they were giving all the new devotees to them. So there was also a problem. Do I want to give new devotees to these people? And in addition to that, there was a lot of confusion in ISKCON due to our lack of understanding of Guru Tattva. We were young devotees, and as I said last week, we understood it when Prabhupada was here because there was little to understand. There's a pure devotee, one guru. What do you have to understand? Everything it says in the books, that's just it. He's perfect, he doesn't make mistakes, etc., etc. So there was nothing to understand. No debate, no other gurus. So now the doubt amongst God brothers started to become, are these people actually qualified? What is a guru? And then they got into that, you know, guru has to be a Mahabhagwat Uttama Adhikari. So that if that's the case, then these people are not qualified. And then what you started seeing is people were looking for shelter because Prabhupada had left, and they saw that their God brothers were not really shelter. They thought they would be, but for many they weren't. Not that they weren't for everybody, but for the people who were losing faith, and for many they were just God brothers. They weren't. There's nothing more than that. You know, this is not the person I can trust my life to the way I did with Prabhupada. Now Prabhupada's gone. I was hoping you all would be someone I could trust, but now what do I do? So this started people looking outside of ISKCON for what you might call, what they're looking for is somebody who is somewhat like Prabhupada in that status, on that level, someone who had far more knowledge and understanding of the tradition and the philosophy than any of their godbrothers. Because at that point in the early 80s, then most devotees had only been 10, 15 years devotees. So now they're looking outside of ISKCON, finding sannyasis who are 80 years old, who took sannyas 30 years ago, you know, like that, who became devotees in 19, whatever, 35, you know, as opposed to someone who was a hippie, became a devotee in 1970. So you started to see this switchover from everything in ISKCON, everything for Prabhupada, to I can't work with these people, I can't trust them. Then you started to see an exodus. Not only were they exiting to take shelter, they were just exiting to go into Maya. Because I would think they were also exiting to just be out of ISKCON and not go into Maya. They didn't want to go, they didn't believe taking shelter outside of ISKCON of another guru was correct, but they didn't have faith and trust to work within ISKCON, so they just would do their devotional service on their own. And then the third group fell into Maya. So that's basically my observation of three groups. One who took shelter outside of ISKCON with other gurus. And then within that, you had another thing that happened temporarily with New Vrindavan, where Kirtanananda kind of went off on his own and he was removed from ISKCON. So you had hundreds of devotees who now were not in Gaudiya Math, they were with Kirtanananda and they weren't in ISKCON. And that included Radhanath Swami. And Chapati at one point was not part of ISKCON. They were just said, "You, if you're with him, you're not." You know, Bhakti Tirtha Swami. These were like people who were with Kirtananda for years and years and years. So when he was asked to leave, they had their allegiance there. So now you had another movement outside of ISKCON. And then later on, a little bit after this, then you had the Ritvik movement, and that was kind of ISKCON, not ISKCON. It wasn't clear because it was called ISKCON Reform. So they want to be ISKCON and they felt they're part of ISKCON, but they just didn't agree with the GBC on the guru issue. I'm sure they agree with the GBC on many issues, but not on the guru issue. So I wanted to talk specifically about the sensitive topic of those who went outside of ISKCON and what defining what outside means, what inside means. And the management of ISKCON will always tend to make it black and white, right? It's like you're either in or you're out, right? Now, I'll tell you a few funny stories, so just you will find interesting, because I don't want to talk of this topic so much in and out. You know, you're either with Prabhupada or you're not. If you're not in ISKCON, you're against the GBC, you're not bona fide. I don't want to talk about it so much that way. I'll talk about it in a way that we can best understand how we fit in or where we should fit in and so forth. So, but first a couple stories which I find, they're interesting stories. So, in the early 80s, the late 70s and early 80s, many devotees went to Prabhupada's godbrother Sridhar Maharaj, including GBC members, to consult him about different things. Things that we had no experience of, that he had many years of experience of, particularly around the guru, particularly around management. And some went to discuss philosophy, perhaps to understand the Vedic planetarium, which I think he and Prabhupada discussed it together. This was their idea, or even maybe his idea, I'm not sure. But anyway, you get the picture, you know. Prabhupada's gone, what do we do about this? Let's go, he's senior, Prabhupada trusted him. Let's ask him. So there are many devotees in ISKCON were getting lectures of him and listening to the lectures. And it wasn't, nobody considered it a problem. It was just, it's like, okay. And many devotees would go and visit him, spend a few days there, listen to him, and then, you know, come here or stay here and go there. It wasn't considered, it was almost considered at that point in time. Perhaps in some people's minds they didn't like it, but in many devotees' minds it wasn't considered wrong or really antagonistic to ISKCON. Many people would say, go ask him, you know, leaders would say, go ask him, what does he say about this? So I went there in 1982 on my way to the Mayapur festival. I had been associated with many devotees who were very close with Sridhar Maharaj. So they said, go stay there. They were going to be there. So I went there. And I spent maybe 5 days or 6 days. And then I came to Mayapur. Now, at this time, I didn't know, but there was a controversy over one guru who had taken drugs and expressed those drug experiences as ecstasy. And so the GBC was trying to deal with him. And what? And what? What?
In ISKCON?
Yeah. These were very difficult times, you know. You could imagine. You have to, you know, he's in charge of many, many temples in ISKCON, some of the biggest temples, and then, you know, you get a call, this is what happened, you know. We found out, and he's expressing this as ecstasies, and LSD is Radharani's, the dust of her feet, and, you know, just like madness like that. Now imagine your guru does that, and you're very attached to your guru. And up to that point, your guru was just a pukka, perfect devotee, and no problem, right? And now this happens. So what he did, he went through some changes, and eventually what he did was he found shelter in Sridharmaraj. That's where he was getting guidance. He didn't trust anyone in ISKCON. And so to get him, so Sridharmaraj helped him get out of that, at least for a while, helped him get out of that and try to situate him properly. But ISKCON didn't want any leader showing this much alignment with someone outside of ISKCON, because when that person says things, it's going to carry a lot of weight, and it may not be exactly what the GBC is saying. Now, even if he's right and the GBC is wrong, still from a managerial point of view, they're not going to think they're wrong. And if it's not aligned, it creates conflict. So, you know, you have one of your leaders and now he's aligned with someone outside of ISKCON. They didn't want that. So they told Jayatirtha that you have to break your connection with him because you're part of ISKCON. And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't break the connection. And this was all going on here in Mayapur during the GBC meetings, this whole conflict, while I was in Sridharmaraj's mat, and I had no idea. It was only when I got to here to Mayapur that I found out, right? So here's the funny story. So apparently they knew I was coming here, and I was coming with another godbrother, and they were afraid that I was being influenced. So as soon as we got into Mayapur, after a few minutes, we were approached by some of our godbrothers and said, we have to talk to you. It was like right away. And so they told us that don't go there, this is not what Prabhupada would want, etc., like that. It's a bad influence. So here's the funny part. The spokesman for that group who was telling me don't go there and telling me all the reasons we shouldn't go there, he is now one of the foremost followers of Sridharmaraj.
No.
True. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Another interesting story. There's another devotee, dedicated follower of Prabhupada, one senior devotee in ISKCON, who I've heard many times speak very critically of anyone who ever left ISKCON, saying that Prabhupada didn't want us to leave, and so if you leave, you're not following Prabhupada, and how can you really be called a Prabhupada man? You know, it's ISKCON all his life. And he had a problem in his personal life, and the GBC gave him in some instructions that he didn't feel were proper to follow, he just didn't feel it was proper for his preaching and what he was doing to make those changes in his life, and he left ISKCON. And he was probably one of the most outspoken people about not leaving ISKCON. So that's why I say the issues aren't so black and white. And some people who leave also are very interested in ISKCON and helping ISKCON, but they don't feel equipped to do it inside. It's their nature, they can't. There are certain personalities that can't. And Prabhupada allowed some devotees to leave ISKCON. He didn't want it, but you know, they couldn't work within it. And he said, so work on your own and follow the principles. So you had that. Okay, these are the principles. Follow them. So Prabhupada once made a statement, which was only made once, and it's not a managerial statement. It was a time and circumstance statement where two devotees were living on their own, and the GBC wanted to kind of integrate them more into ISKCON. And Prabhupada said, just leave them, they're fine. And he said, wherever two devotees or three devotees are together chanting Hare Krishna, that's ISKCON. So he made that, you know, very broad statement. Now, that obviously doesn't work for management, but it works for the sake of discussing a topic in a less black and white way, it works, right? So we can have the broadest definition wherever you're chanting their ISKCON. And wherever there are Prabhupada disciples preaching, they're representing Prabhupada, but they're not representing it through that organization. And that was Prabhupada's ultimate desire, that it would be represented through the organization. That's what he wanted, right? So that's where the controversy comes in, and that's what I wanted to talk about a little bit, in the history. So there were many devotees who became attached to Sridhar Maharaj and went with him, not just Jayachandra, but many, a good number. So, sannyasis, leaders, not a good number, but a fair amount. And he encouraged them to preach. If they couldn't, they were coming to him saying, I can't work with an ISKCON. So he said, then just, you know, preach anyway. Don't give up Krishna consciousness. And he could be accused of not getting them back in ISKCON. But whatever the case, I was there for a week, and I never heard him tell anybody not to work with an ISKCON. It was just people would come and say, I can't work with an ISKCON. And his response is, well, if you can't, just maintain the mission and preach. So that's basically what they were doing. So, you know, some people faulted him that you should have gone back to ISKCON. When I went, I was quite disgruntled with ISKCON. And I spent a week with him and heard him speak, and that repaired any ill feelings I had by his speaking. So it's not true that he was pushing people away from ISKCON, although people thought that. He didn't push me away. He actually mended my relationship. I don't know what he said, but he definitely wasn't antagonistic. But it appeared that way because, say, well, Jayatirtha, he couldn't get Jayatirtha. He was the one I was talking about that left ISKCON, right? He couldn't get him back. So now, the other thing that happened with this devotee, Jayatirtha, when the GBC pushed him, he said, if you push me to give up my relationship with Sridhar Maharaj, I'm going to leave ISKCON, and I'm going to take my disciples with me. Which meant most of England was his disciples. So I think the British Atra lost like half or a third or two-thirds of their devotees. You know, it was a collapse. In South Africa, I had to close a temple. I was temple president. I had to close it. I didn't have any devotees. We lost because so many people went with him. And most of those people who went with him, or a lot of them, they just ended up leaving, because he ended up leaving also. So you could see subsequently the GBC was very concerned about people leaving ISKCON based on that kind of experience. It was traumatic. Traumatic. We lost so many devotees, and the collapse of so many programs, or just a real struggle. So we saw, okay, this is what happens when a leader becomes attached to somebody outside. So even though it's not the fault of the person outside, but it's like for people who want to be independent, it's something they can hold on to, and the person they're holding on to may not realize what's happening, but inadvertently they get encouraged to be independent in a way that could cause damage. So that's why there were these strange feelings about going outside of ISKCON, because every time it happened, we'd lose devotees, you know. Or so that's a general history. And the psychology is that people who go out, they usually go out thinking there are problems within ISKCON, and they've found shelter, which is better, and they're getting more enlightenment, more knowledge, and they're not having to deal with the problems of ISKCON. So they're, in a sense, in a better situation because they're getting better guidance, they're getting more clarity, and they don't want to take part in what they see to be false within ISKCON. So then you get a little bit of this we're better than you mentality. And when that we're better than you mentality, it can lead to sometimes canvassing people in ISKCON to join, or disciples canvassing people in ISKCON, or just speaking ill about ISKCON, to kind of rationalize why you've left or explain why you've left. Or actually you just feel ISKCON's a problem and you feel that people would be better in my organization. It's some combination of that. It's natural to human psychology. You have a roaming call. I thought I'd get a call on my actually get calls on your, this is a mobile connection. Oh my god.
Oh.
How do I like hang up to me? A voice call is coming. How would anyone even have my number? That's like amazing. Oh, there's a hang up. I got it. It's a solicitor, I'm sure. Okay. This is a difficult, it's such a difficult topic to explain because I want to explain it realistically and I don't want to offend anybody. And it's very easy to do it, right? And I totally understand why people leave ISKCON. I completely understand it. And I've heard them speak about it. And there are many very wonderful devotees who spent their whole life in ISKCON, where if Prabhupada didn't say don't leave, they probably would have left. There's many, I can tell you that. It's a frustrating environment to work in organizations. It's a lot easier to go off on your own if you're qualified, or with a few godbrothers and start something, you know, and then not have to be under anyone, any GBC or passing rules or regulations or telling you you can't go and hear from this person. So I understand why people leave. And as I say, if Prabhupada gave us the green light to leave, you would not see as many people in ISKCON as you. I think we would have all fractioned off and started. Many would have fractioned off and started if Prabhupada said that's okay. But he said it's not okay. And we had the precedent of the Gaudiya Math that they did it, and he said, don't do it. Don't be another Gaudiya Math. So we had that there. So that's why there was so much concern on the part of the GBC of people going outside, because Prabhupada had made it clear that the failure of the Gaudiya Math was that they split up. So there's the GBC and the leaders, anything they wanted, of anything they wanted, that was the one thing they didn't want to happen. Because that Prabhupada made it clear. That's why the Gaudiya Math, that was the failure of the Gaudiya Math. In spite of all the great preachers and the great preaching they did, it all happened independently, so it didn't have the unified power that it would have had if they stayed together. You know, you have a little preaching program, I have a little, but we get together and we form a society, and now we're synergistically working. So Prabhupada saw his spiritual master's movement destroyed by that. So he's very careful to instruct us, no matter what, stay together, work together. So that was the challenge. And there were people who just couldn't do it. It was going against their own, how would you say, you could say going against their own integrity, their own consciousness, that I can't be part of this. Some people became very attached to Sridhar Maharaj. And then what happened is, because after Jayatirtha went, there's this huge fear that his disciples are going to go, and subsequently it could affect future generations of gurus who even might go. So there's a lot of strong preaching against Sridhar Maharaj, against going there and going outside of ISKCON, and just against Prabhupada's godbrothers in general. And so some of the people that had become attached to Sridhar Maharaj, they were prevented from going to hear him. They said, if you want to stay in ISKCON, you can't go. You can't. And they had to listen to criticism of him. So some of them couldn't stay. They left. Said, I can't. If that's what's going on here, I can't stay. Now, you could criticize them and say, you should have given your allegiance to Prabhupada and so on. You shouldn't have left. You know, and that's reasonable. But I'm just saying those people couldn't. Their affection was too strong and their allegiance was too strong, and so that's what they did, and they started their own movements. Or they continued within his organization, or they created branches of their own organizations. And there are many such organizations now around the world. Some of them in some parts of the world are more successful than ISKCON, as you know, in Mexico, South America, with Paramadvaiti Swami. He's very extremely successful. Paramadvaiti Swami. Yeah, Vrinda, yeah. Yeah, extremely successful in his preaching. He's in Mexico, right? And South America. Yeah, very successful. So, so we saw an exodus around people taking shelter of Sri Dharmaraj and then beginning their own temples or organizations or working with him. Not a huge exodus, but an exodus. And then that meant that all of the people new to Krishna consciousness who came in their temples didn't know anything about ISKCON. They don't know about ISKCON. I mean, not that they don't know anything, but they don't have the experience of ISKCON. And they don't have the experience of Prabhupada the way we have it, because now it's one person who's a disciple of Prabhupada. You have access to hundreds of disciples of Prabhupada. And you're in a movement that totally focuses on Prabhupada and no one else. Where in their movement, of course, there's Prabhupada, there's also Sridhar Maharaj. And it's just different. It's different than they've joined ISKCON. And it's going to be a little challenging when he leaves. Because if your guru leaves, you've got a lot of other gurus and a lot of other god brothers and god sisters. If I leave and I start my own organization with a few disciples and I leave, they only have themselves. Here you're doing Bhakti Shastri. I have no Bhakti Shastri in my organization, so what do? You know, I have no Bhakti Vai Baba. You know, so they don't have that infrastructure, you know, which was kind of the obvious reason why Prabhupada wanted to stay together, because you have this huge infrastructure that protects everyone. So that's just the challenge those organizations will have to deal with. Perhaps it's a handicap, perhaps it's not. From my perspective, it seems like definitely a challenge. And from my perspective, I can't speak from my perspective, because I've never really associated with disciples of these gurus. But even in ISKCON, where Prabhupada's the center, a lot of people don't have a deep connection with Prabhupada. So I would imagine it would be similar outside. So, in any case, that's perhaps some of the differences and some of the challenges that they have to go through, which I think Prabhupada felt would be better if they didn't have to do that, right? So that went on, and you know, you could say people that could have joined ISKCON didn't, inadvertently or by them actively trying to get them, which doesn't happen so much anymore, but it was a little bit like that. Now you could look at it from another point of view, which is they went to places where there were no devotees and started preaching, and people became devotees. So if they didn't go there, those people wouldn't be devotees. So you can look at it in a positive sense and say, well, this is a good thing that people went independent and did their own thing, because if they were in ISKCON, perhaps that wouldn't have happened. They wouldn't have been able to go to these places. They maybe had other responsibilities. You could offer that as a positive argument and say, well, why don't we just allow them to be part of the greater ISKCON? And that's been discussed, like sister temples. Or you create a greater ISKCON. It can include people who were not working directly with the GBC, but working with some GBC member, perhaps, who's a friend and kind of, in some way, working, you know, so that they're ISKCON, but they're not. You know, it's ISKCON friendly. So that discussion took place. I don't know the details of that discussion, but all I was told is that it wasn't... They weren't open to that at this point. It doesn't mean in the future ISKCON wouldn't be open to it. Other organizations are like that. You're not considered directly ISKCON, but you're part of a broader ISKCON family as a disciple of Prabhupada and a god brother of members of ISKCON. So, you know, it's a working relationship. And then if that were true, then sannyasis would travel and preach, and those centers would be open to ISKCON sannyasis. So, you know, and then... the good things that organization was doing that ISKCON wasn't, because that organization didn't have a bottleneck of hierarchy. They could just get an idea and do it, where ISKCON might say, don't do that, it's not good. They could go and do it and try it out. So the benefits they were getting in their preaching from experimenting in different ways, or just their own ingenuity that wasn't bottlenecked with meetings with other people, then ISKCON would get the benefit. So some devotees saw that that would be good, that we could both mutually benefit. By this point in time, and it didn't pass. But so what I observed, and this is just from my perspective, that when those movements started, they were more antagonistic to ISKCON than they are now. Now I don't even see that there's much interaction or thinking, but in the earlier days there was. And there was some fear of them taking devotees away. And still it happens that people from ISKCON join those organizations. It still happens. And ISKCON's not happy about it because it's a different organization. You've lost people who were dedicated to ISKCON. It's not the worst thing in the world because they're also preaching. So you have pros and cons. But the general mood, as I said, is ISKCON, we're given that instruction by Prabhupada, don't become another Gaudiya Math. So, but Prabhupada tried to engage the Gaudiya Math in helping ISKCON, which gives some credence to the idea of let's be one big, larger family. I think ISKCON was a little bit open to the idea, but perhaps there were individuals that they didn't think they could work well with, and it was more of a problem of the individual than the idea itself. So the first exodus in ISKCON we saw was to Sridhar Maharaj. And that continued after he left with his disciple Govinda Maharaj, who continued the organization. And then new recruits that were just coming into the organization. And they established centers in all over the world. They're in Russia, they're preaching in Russia. I don't know. Govinda. Well, Govinda was the successor. Now I don't know. The successor of Govinda, he's no longer alive. I don't know who that is. But people like Tripura Rai Maharaj, they would start their own organization. Dira Krishna Maharaj, he had started a center for Sridhar Maharaj in California. Jagaguru Swami, now known as Nisringa Maharaj, he has his own center. They're all very powerful, successful preachers, no question. And if I played a video... Yes?
What about connecting between them, about the
disciples? Oh, how they connect? I don't know the details, but they don't... Not all of them followed Govinda Maharaj and worked within their organizations. So some of them worked on their own. But if I played you an audio or video of them and I didn't tell you who they were, the only way you could really tell that they weren't in ISKCON is just by hearing them refer to Sridhar Maharaj or Guru Maharaj, you know, mother. Who's Guru Maharaj? Or a few words that might be Gaudiya Math slang that we're not familiar with, and that would be, other than that, you wouldn't know. It's not anything they say wouldn't make you think that's wrong. Or, at least 99% or 98% you would see the same. So that's why some devotees were a little concerned that they couldn't be involved in ISKCON because they're not saying anything different than we are. But in any case, the different preachers, Paramadvaiti Swami, he's got his own organization, Nisringa Maharaj has his, Tripurai Swami has his, and then some, I think maybe Dira Krishna Maharaj, he may have followed in Sridhar Maharaj's Gaudiya Math through Govinda Maharaj, and they just opening centers under that name. And so they're going on, they're preaching. You know, so who could say preaching is bad? Right? We would be happier if they were preaching in ISKCON, but it didn't happen. Right? So now it gets interesting here. And this is just like history. Interesting. I don't know if this is helping you, all of you out there, but I'm hoping to make it help you. I don't know. I'm doing more damage than good, but let's see where we get to. I'm trying to more go over the history now, you know. So then what happened was Narayana Maharaj, who was a disciple of Prabhupada's godbrother, was always a well-wisher and dear friend of Prabhupada, and very learned in Krishna consciousness. And there were a group of devotees who wanted to go deeper in their understanding of Raghunuga Bhakti and Rasa and things of this nature, and they didn't know where to go. And they started going to him on a regular basis. And he was not a controversial figure. He didn't have a huge following of Westerners. I don't think he had any at that point. And so there was a group of senior devotees who would go regularly and hear from him. And a lot of what he was teaching was filtering into ISKCON through them. And they were specifically concerned with topics which weren't generally discussed, because we didn't know much about them. And so they were learning from him and developing a very close relationship. And for many years, everybody thought this was valuable, because he's giving information we didn't have, and these devotees are giving it to us. And then there was a contingent of devotees who said that many of our leaders are going there and being strongly influenced by him, and that means there's an influence coming from Gaudiya Math into ISKCON, and this is not healthy. So at a certain point, around 92, it came up at the GBC meeting, and the GBC wanted to break all connection with him, because they felt that his influence was so strong over the leaders, it could become a problem, that here's this person who's not a disciple of Prabhupada, who's not, you know, part of ISKCON, and he has an extreme amount of influence over leadership of ISKCON and how they're understanding, but probably more important is just the relationship and the influence that relationship would have inadvertently, unexpectedly. You understand? Not consciously. It was just, it's like, let's say you're working closely with another devotee, man, right? And there's nothing going on between you. It's just service, right? But everyone else is saying, no, we know where this is going. You know, and you're saying, what are you talking about? It's just, you know, I do service, he does service, and we're doing the same service because we have the same training and we're from the same country and we speak the same language, and so for you two it's just good, it's beneficial, your service is increasing, his is increasing, but everyone else is saying, no, we know where this is going, if this continues there's something's going to go on here. You understand? I'm just using you, but I'm just, you know, any woman, right? Any woman, any man, by working together long enough, too closely, right? So it was kind of like that. Devotees were seeing, okay, well, you know, these devotees are going all the time to hear from him. Something's going to happen where his influence is really going to predominate and maybe conflict with the influence of the GBC. And a lot of what these devotees are preaching it's not the same spice that Prabhupada used in his preaching. And it's not the same emphasis. So the emphasis was definitely different, because they were going to extract specific knowledge from him, and then they were delivering that to ISKCON, which was, I mean, the knowledge was good, but it was coming in that dose predominantly, and it wasn't the way Prabhupada preached. As you know, Prabhupada preached in a very balanced, roundabout way. He didn't focus on any one thing too much, tried to give a balanced view, and he didn't take us to areas which were a little stretches for us. And so the topics they were talking about were very, very elevated. So it came up. Many of the senior people were going there and developing very affectionate relationships, and it came up, I believe, in 1992. And the GBC passed a resolution that no one could have any connection with him, which actually, in a sense, created a movement for Narayan Raj. Because when you say you can't, it creates, you become more popular. And I think there were some people said, I can't give up that connection. Others, most followed, if not all, or who were going there, who were the leaders, and who the GBC said no, they gave it up. But there may have been other people who weren't leaders who didn't give it up. Not maybe, there were. And it actually made it worse, in a sense, because look what the GBC has done. This relationship is so beneficial, and they've pulled it away from them. Thank you. So there were a lot of people who stuck around. And it was Narayamaharaj was a great friend of ISKCON and a well-wisher. And that was a blow that really hurt him and hurt his relationship with ISKCON. And his attitude toward ISKCON had seemed to change after that. And devotees who were going to him personally told me that he was very hurt by that because the relationships were very deep and the GBC was very heavy. So the relationships were, they were like cut. It was like, you know, you have a very deep relationship with someone and then just cut it one day. You know, it's hurtful. So he was hurt. But what had been happening is that gradually a lot of these disinfected, disenfranchised devotees were finding shelter in him as they had found shelter in Sridhar Maharaj. So the Sridhar Maharaj took place much earlier, like the late 70s, and now this was taking place later, like the late 80s. But this was becoming a bigger movement, and more devotees were going, and Sridhar Maharaj started traveling around the world. I mean, Narayamaharaj. Sridhar Maharaj didn't travel, he stayed in one place. Now Narayamaharaj traveling, he was going to places and communities where devotees were had lost faith in ISKCON. And so whole communities would become his followers. Not uncommon. He'd go somewhere and, you know, like independent householder communities or ISKCON communities that were weak, and he'd come and rejuvenate them. So everyone became very attached. So there was a movement starting around him. And because he had been hurt by ISKCON, he wasn't like telling people to be part of ISKCON. He said, you come to me, I'll help you. Not in an antagonistic way, but it created a movement. And then naturally, his followers are thinking this is better than ISKCON, so they're going to ISKCON devotees and say, come here, hear from him, this will help you. Now, what makes it not so black and white, in one sense, is that many people who had lost their spiritual life got rejuvenated by going to him, because only a figure of his status could help them. Like it was like another prophet coming, you know. When he's coming to the West, he's probably 80 years old. That means he's been a sannyasi for 30 years. He's been a devotee for whoever, you know, since he was young. So maybe he's been a devotee 50 years, 60 years. So that caliber of devotee and that power of that devotee helped so many devotees who had fallen away from Krishna consciousness. So you couldn't deny that. That's what makes the whole issue difficult to deal with. Because devotees are saying, he saved me. And now you're saying, you know, he's bad. And when this junction, resolution was passed, that they had to pull from ISKCON, it was also passed that Narayamaharaj could not preach in any temple of ISKCON. It was stopped. I guess before he was able to, it was just, you know, like he was banned. So that was pretty heavy, you know, because he was very close to Prabhupada. And now you can visit a temple, but you can't talk. And naturally, his disciples were upset with ISKCON. So, it, you know, there was some friction there. And, you know, initially, his whole movement of Western people were all ISKCON people. There weren't new people. They were all people that were in ISKCON. So that was a problem for ISKCON. And he wasn't preaching everything that was exactly the way, you know, as I said, with the same spice as Prabhupada preached. Now people were distributing his books. The same people that distributed Prabhupada's books were not, you know. So naturally ISKCON's looking at this and saying, this is not what Prabhupada wanted. And the disciples are saying, no, these books, you know, people should read these books. It's really powerful. It really help you. So there are two really distinct ways of, you know, looking at it. One from the inside, one from the outside. So and he started, you know, these same ex-ISKCON temple presidents are now starting temples for his organization, are now organizing book distribution for his organization, are now doing everything they did for Prabhupada, for him, in a new organization, often in the same cities as where we had temples. You know, so it was something we never had to deal with when Prabhupada was here. Yes?
I went to the temple in Mexico City. I went
before I was in ISKCON. But I was really close to Prabhupada in that moment. And I did a lie the on the inside the temple. They have like a small chair with a small picture of Prabhupada. And a big picture of
Narayana Maharaj.
For me was really, for me I feel often you know, because
so that's a good point. So yeah, that's what I mean. It's different. It's different. But here's where it gets interesting. The followers of Govinda Maharaj, Sridhar Maharaj, and those group of devotees, and the followers of Narayana Maharaj, they have a lot of disagreements, philosophical disagreements. And so they don't get along that well. That, you know, they're not together. And they never will be together. There, you know. So, and as I said, even the followers of Sridhar Maharaj, they have their own organizations, right? So now, from the GBC perspective, they're looking at this and saying, "See, this is what Prabhupada said. And this is what Gaudiya Math did. They all, you know, all the temples you see here. What are they? They're one man in the Gaudiya Math who started his own temple. They're not a unified Gaudiya Math. They're still a Gaudiya Math main center, but these others are not." I mean, there may be a few here and there. So from the GBC perspective, they're saying, yeah, now, see what's happening? He's got a temple, he's got a temple, he's got a temple. And they're not even getting along so well, even amongst the same organization. And now, Narayana Maharaj is no longer in this world. And obviously, they're going to have their challenges getting along and unifying their movement and so forth. So Prabhupada had told us, form a GBC, because that's what his spiritual master wanted, and said, work together, and then that famous statement, you'll show your love for me by how you cooperate. So that's the problem of leaving ISKCON, is not that you don't have a good reason. If anyone wants to leave ISKCON, I'm sure they got plenty of good reasons, because everyone's been mistreated by somebody, if not cheated, if not, and if you haven't, you will be sooner or later. Some leader is going to tell you, promise you something and not give it to you. You know, some new leader is going to come in and take away what was promised to you. It happens, right? And everybody's got stories, especially if you've been in as long as I've been in. You got a lot of stories, right? And all of these stories are your reasons, like valid reasons why you could leave. And if you told anybody the stories, they couldn't really argue with you. So that's not the level we're arguing. We're arguing the principle that Prabhupada wanted us to work under a GBC. That's the main thing. Not that the GBC is always right or perfect, but under them. That's what he wanted. He obviously knew we're not perfect. He obviously knew we would make mistakes. But I think he felt if we're sincere, not that I think, I know, if we're sincere, if we make a mistake, it'll eventually get corrected. It may take 50 years. But, you know, and there'll be a lot of damage in those 50 years. But I think the alternative of independent organizations, maybe with less damage because there's more control of lesser numbers of individuals, smaller organization, but it will never prosper ultimately. So even with all the damage, we'll prosper more, right? I mean, look at our movement, despite it all. Right? Despite the fact that most of the Prabhupada disciples are not active in ISKCON, still, it's going, despite the fact there's a Ritvik movement, despite the fact that 8 of the original 11 fell down, or 8.5. 8 fell down, and one had some trouble. The movement's still going on. You know. So Prabhupada understood that, right? So that was the idea of staying within, even if you don't like it, and even if you see the faults and the problems, because at least it creates cohesion, right? So, you know, if one or two people leave, you know, they're not going to feel like, well, I'm ruining the movement. But if we have 130 gurus now, if half leave, that's a huge problem, right? That means half the movement of initiated people, right, are now confused and would leave with them. Now, so if we go back to Jayatirtha in 1982 and his attachment to Sridhar Maharaj and the GBC saying, if you stay with him, you can't stay within ISKCON. And then he said, well, I'm just going to leave. Then this was the first time ISKCON had to deal with the situation. What does a disciple do if his guru leaves ISKCON? who do you follow, the GBC or your guru? Because the guru is saying, come with me, and the GBC is saying, stay in ISKCON. It was the first time we had to deal with this. So obviously with Prabhupada, you wouldn't deal with that, because nobody would, if you left ISKCON, you just left ISKCON. You weren't leaving to join another movement. So this brought up an issue which is still, it's still problematic today. Who is your allegiance to? And how much of your allegiance is to who? Is it to an institution? Or is it to your guru? And if it's to both, how do you balance it? If your guru leaves, do you leave also? And one of the things that we saw within the Jayatirtha era, which was, of course, at that time, it was very new to us and very immature, that for most disciples, it was, if your guru goes, you go. Because your guru is everything, right? And that's kind of the what you might call, what Sureshwar, I think he calls it, the Diksha Guru syndrome. That everything is the Diksha Guru. The Diksha Guru is everything, right? That's why when you went to the Narayan Rish temple, Prabhupada had a little picture, because the Diksha Guru is everything, right? And so that brought up that whole issue when Jayatirtha was leaving, you know, because until that point in ISKCON, the Diksha Guru was everything. And if the Diksha Guru said, leave, you'd go. Leave ISKCON. He's my guru. If he says, leave ISKCON, I do. There wasn't this loyalty, and there wasn't this balance to what, well, he's your Diksha Guru, but Prabhupada's your Siksha Guru. And this is Prabhupada's movement. And he's Prabhupada's disciple. So if he's leaving ISKCON, what are you supposed to do? So then, you know, some of them did not leave because some of them understood it. And today, if this happens, very few will leave. Most will stay within ISKCON because they'll understand my guru's validity is his connection with Prabhupada. Okay, he has validity as a spiritual teacher outside of ISKCON, but he doesn't have the validity of what I connected to when I took initiation within ISKCON. That's gone now that he left. So devotees will understand that. Philosophically, you can't. It doesn't make sense philosophically. He's my guru. He's my eternal Lord and Master. But as Sureshwar says, it's part of that Diksha Guru syndrome. Well, he's everything, but he's only one part of an equation. So then when the GBC a couple of years ago came out with a paper, Parallel Lines of Authority, this is Jayatirtha 1982. This paper is 30 years later, and it's still a problem. That still leaders are complaining, you know, that Diksha Gurus have too much power over local management. So you have this, you know, complaints like more money leaves our country in donations than is given to our temple, to all the gurus who live outside, who come in, collect money. These kinds of issues. Or, you know, working, he's an important man and you're pulling him out to work for your project. So what power does a guru have? What's the influence? Where's the loyalty of the disciple? So now some gurus will tell their disciples at initiation, if I ever leave ISKCON, you stay. So that's kind of like, you're being initiated, I'm your guru, but you're also part of ISKCON, and that's where your loyalty lies and your deepest connection is with Prabhupada. So if I ever give up that connection, don't follow me. Obviously some will follow because there's an emotional bond and attachment and affection. But that's the principle. If I go, you stay. Your loyalty is to Prabhupada. If I get crazy, your loyalty is to Prabhupada. You understand? Yes? Yeah. So that's where the movement's at now, because the movement, it realizes that the best thing for the world and the best thing for the disciple is to work within the organization, no matter how crazy and weird it gets. So my analogy is this, and I think it's a good analogy, but I don't think everyone will agree with it, but anyway, it's my analogy. And I know some people won't agree with it, and I know exactly why they won't agree with it. And I respect their opinion, and their point is also valid, but I think their point is also a reflection of their own nature, which is why they can't agree with it. So here's my analogy. We're all together. We all work together as a team, and working together as a team, we all realize we accomplish much more than we do as individuals, right? And everyone experiences that. So we have a team here, a group of us, 10, 20, 30, 30,000, whatever. We're moving and making things happen as a team. On our own, we may be doing very little. Okay, so is it possible for this team to go off, to misunderstand something, to make a wrong decision? Of course. Is it possible to not be entirely clear on the philosophy and preach something that later we realize is wrong? Yes. How can we say yes? Because we've already done that in ISKCON, right? Are we perfectly clear on everything right now in terms of the future? Maybe not. So someone will say, then I don't want to be part of that. Because why should I follow a leadership that has made so many mistakes in the past and is still not entirely clear at the present? That's the argument that people will make against the argument that I'm going to make. And here's my argument. So, we're on a trip, we're all together, and we get lost. Would you rather be lost with a group, or would you rather be lost on your own? So, even though we're lost, we're still together. And the chances of us finding our way back are greater if we're together. And when we find our way back, we're still together. Whereas if we go off on our own, number one, even if we don't get lost, we're on our own. So we lose that synergy. And number two, if we do get lost, we're going to have a harder time finding our way back because we're alone. And so the analogy is that in ISKCON, we sometimes make mistakes, but gradually we realize them. So we do get lost sometimes, but we stay together. And so when we find our way back, we're still together. That's my analogy. And I think that's Prabhupada understood that. Is why we stay together. Okay, you may make mistakes, but you'll get back, and you're still together when you get back. And the chances of finding your way back are greater in a group. Now, someone may say, on my own, I never would have followed you. I wouldn't have got lost. Okay, that's okay, but how much can you do on your own? You may do a lot. You may be an empowered preacher, but you could do more within the organization. Right? Because now, if you look at... Okay. Now let's take another example, that you're so empowered that you can do as much as ISKCON, or almost as much, or as much or more than any single person in ISKCON. Like you take Chab Takamrash, that's like phenomenal what he's done, right? But let's say there's somebody outside of ISKCON, and there is, who's done the same thing, who has that many disciples, who aren't Indian, who are Westerners, which is quite a phenomenal thing to do. There's somebody like preaching who's got 20,000 Western disciples. That's amazing, right? But how much more powerful would ISKCON be if he and his 20,000 disciples were working within the organization? So we can't minimize his success. We have to applaud it. So you're amazing. You went off on your own, and look what you did. You're empowered. So we're not minimizing the spiritual power of these devotees. We're just looking at it practically, saying, the future of ISKCON, the future of your organization would both be improved. Now he might say, but I could have never made those 20,000 disciples if I were in ISKCON. And he's probably right. So that's a defect of ISKCON, that we maybe couldn't allow him the independence to do it the way he wanted to do it, because he did it in a different way than standard in ISKCON. And what we see in ISKCON, when people try... Okay, now we're going to end. We just got back online just in time to end and let you ask questions. So now you see me and you hear me, but it doesn't sound as good as before because we're using a different mic. So this mic decided didn't like the computer. So I think we're going to have to continue this class because I haven't really said everything I would like to say. You have a question, but we can do questions.
We're going to be gone, so.
Oh, okay.
Well, we're meeting for 2 weeks, so I won't be able to.
Hear the climax. You want to hear the climax now?
Yes.
Okay.
I think one of the points you brought up is extremely important.
Christians.
Yeah, but I want to respond to your point. While we were gone, we were making the point that, I know a lot of these devotees are my friends. We're in this other movement. Other movements, they're friends. We have relationships. And they're good devotees. It's just, sometimes brothers and sisters can't work together, can't live together. So one huge mistake that we make is we make offenses. You left Prabhupada, what, you know, like that. So, and some offenses can get severe. And making offenses against their groups that they've taken shelter. So, we definitely want to avoid that, for sure. This is a common problem. And the reason it's a problem is because some of these people are criticized within ISKCON and even criticized by your authorities. Probably less now than before, but I've been involved with seeing the effects of devotees hearing criticism of these other people. Like they're sometimes leave themselves open to criticism. They may say things which are very anti-ISKCON and very untrue, and maybe say demeaning things about devotees you respect. So it's all Maya's enticement to, you know, respond with similar unsavory or unkind or in some way critical statements. Now that's not good. And I think a lot of what they say may be taken out of context and then thrown out. He said this. What he meant was not these three words. He gave a whole lecture and he picked out three words. So we want to understand that. We want to understand that there are devotees in our movement who are working, who have affinities for some of these other people in Bodhi Math. But they keep it to themselves. There are many, many devotees who really like to admire what he's doing, what he's preaching. Some read the books of Narayana Maharaj. Some read the books of Sridhar Maharaj. And many read the books of Sridhar Maharaj. For this year, this kind of devotees. On this kind of life. Says, don't read those books, and many read it. So we have to understand these realities, right? But there's a difference. If you're staying and working in ISKCON, there's a difference. So you might say, okay, he reads it, but he's just, you know, clarifying information that he can't get anywhere else, but he's dedicated to ISKCON. It's not making him leave. So what I've noticed is that some people by nature have a more difficult time working within an organization, and therefore when they learn from other gurus, it's natural they become a little more attached to them. And it's easier for them to leave an organization because it's harder for them. They're independent people. They're, you know, they're thoughtful, they see what's wrong. And so we should understand that. But at the same time, we should understand but ultimately, we shouldn't leave, and it's not what Prabhupada wanted us to do. If you're maintaining this balance of not being offensive, maybe even somewhat understanding of why somebody would leave, but at the same time, working within this time. But we never really got to that point about that allegiance between Guru and ISKCON and GBC. That's a super sensitive point, right? Because when Prabhupada established the movement, as I said last week, what he did was he established the GBC as the ultimate. He didn't establish the gurus as the ultimate. So in a traditional guru-disciple relationship, and in our shastra, the guru is the ultimate. Now you've actually, to say that there's a managerial body that's above the guru could be philosophically proven to be untrue, false. And you can be said to be bogus for saying that. And I've heard people say, that's bogus. The highest authority for the disciples of Guru, not a body of people. They cannot interfere. It's a relationship. Like they say, don't get in the way between husband and wife because you're going to regret it. Someone's going to turn against you, maybe both of them. So don't get in the way between Guru and disciple. But within our organization, sometimes we have to get a little bit in the way because gurus fall down, or they do some indiscretionary thing, and then the GBC has to kind of deal with the disciples, as they had to do with Jayachari. So we're not in that same situation. And therefore, when we understand our ultimate allegiance to Prabhupada, and we understand the relative position of the Diksha Guru to Prabhupada, to ISKCON, to the GBC, we can start to overcome the quote-unquote Diksha Guru syndrome. The Diksha Guru is, he's everything, and Prabhupada's out here, and other helpers are out here, and GBC is some alien body we have that really no relation to. I don't even know what they are. I don't know who they are. Who are they? What do they do? What relevance do they have to me? But from Prabhupada's perspective, they're the ones who are leading the movement. And that to keep a movement together, everyone has to follow, even if they don't agree. That's what keeps it unified. So even the gurus have to follow the GBC, so that makes the GBC higher in a managerial sense, not a spiritual sense. Instructions of the GBC are not higher unless it comes to the point where your guru is rejecting Prabhupada, rejecting ISKCON, or falling. So that's really hard because philosophically you can't prove that. You can't go to Shastra and say, what shloka can you quote or what commentary can you quote to prove that? You can't. It's wrong. Philosophically, it's not really right. If there's anybody above the guru. But in our situation, yes, Prabhupada is above your guru. Your allegiance is to Prabhupada. If your guru deviates from Prabhupada, your allegiance is to him. That's your primary connection. That's what we're... And so if your primary connection with Prabhupada, then it has to be with his instructions, and his instructions was that if you stay in ISKCON, the GBC is the leader. That's what gives them that authority, which for most devotees in our movement, they never have to deal with that because their guru is not going to deviate. But when they do, or when their guru says something which is not Krishna conscious, then it could come down to, okay, the GBC comes down and says, this is not correct. I always cover myself. I say, I don't know if the GBC will accept what I say, but this is what I've said. So it's like, okay, they may not accept it, and if they don't, I'll follow what they say until they come and hammer me on the head. This is what I said. We have to be like that. I say this, if they say it's wrong, I have to accept that. Or at least if they say don't preach it, then I won't. If I have to, then I have to tell my disciples, okay, you know, that thing I said, just forget it. It's not proper. So I have to be subordinate, that they could chastise me. Right? So in a sense, you know, like I could do whatever I want, and I'm Prabhupada's disciple, I can initiate whoever I want, but within ISKCON, I can't. Then I have to get approval. And I have to get some, you know, I have to work with temples, and I can't just initiate someone who just joined yesterday. So the temple president's going to upset him. I said, you can't do that. This devotee's been waiting for 5 years, and you initiated her, and she just joined yesterday. So, you know, we're working with him. You know, we're taking philosophy and saying, okay, in this context, this is the philosophy, but in this context, the philosophy has to change or morph or adapt to the structure of an organization. So then it kind of sometimes doesn't look like philosophy. But the point is it gets the result of keeping a unified movement, which is our main service to Prabhupada, is to stay unified. That's what he wanted, you know. If we don't, then we don't fulfill his mission. So, what do you think of that? Did that answer your question before you asked it, or you have another question? What?
Some question I also I wanted to ask maybe because we think like Guru Shastri Sadhu.
Yes.
Shastri is highest of that. Because one time I heard this and now I'm not sure.
No. The actual highest is the Sadhu and the Guru.
Sadhu.
And Guru.
Well,
Guru and Sadhu
is the same. It's mean if we will accept GBC as a Sadhu, maybe it could be like it's like GBC
well,
as a Sadhu.
Yeah. GBC as Sadhu. Because
it's
what...
We follow the Shastra. Because if we have Sadhu...
You're getting the Shastra from the Sadhu. You just want to make sure that this... I mean, like we said last week, it's not so much, these things are not so much concerns in ISKCON, because everyone you hear from is a sadhu or a guru. So when you're living in a little village in the middle of nowhere and there's no ISKCON, and you hear somebody speak, and then you think, is he speaking according to Shastra? Because if he isn't, I don't listen to him. If you do that in ISKCON, you're going to end up making a lot of offenses. Because you're always thinking, well, is he speaking according to Shastra? I've never heard this before. So it's a general principle, right, that the guru speaks according to Shastra. He represents Shastra. But that's all that we do. It's not like in ISKCON there's six upasampradayas going on. You know, you have to be careful. You know, maybe there's some gurus who are preaching something that's wrong. It's just the nature of the movement. If there were, it would be stopped. Right? So it's kind of like we're protected in that sense. But if ever, for example, you heard something that just didn't make sense to you, then you would say, Maharaj, where does it say that in the Shastra? I've never heard that before. What's the evidence? Just for your own satisfaction that this is bona fide. So I've never heard this before. Can you explain? And he has to explain it from Shastra. That's his authority. So that's the idea. But the idea of the sadhu being more important is that the revelation of the sadhu is more important than Shastra. Because how do you understand Shastra without the sadhu or the guru? Mm-hmm. So it's actually deeper. Mm-hmm. Right? So, no, not everyone will agree with that, but that's the general idea. Mm-hmm. I think most people will agree. I've heard some people not agree, but they weren't exactly Gaudiya Vaishnavas. Mm-hmm. They may give more credence to Shastra, but our understanding is that the conclusion of Shastra is in the heart of the sadhu. He understands it through realization. Verses in Mahabharata. You understand it's guhyam within the guhyam within the heart. The tattva, guhyam. The tattva is in the guhyam of the pure devotee. The truth is in the heart of the pure devotee. That's where it resides. So Prabhupada said, you wouldn't understand Gita without my purport. So Gita is the Shastra, but how do you understand it? Through the sadhu. And then your guru represents Prabhupada, so he's representing Shastra and sadhu. So they all should line up. So practically, it would be that there's some tension going on with your guru or some respected devotee that they're preaching something. And it's dividing people in ISKCON on different sides. And then, okay, now we have to go guru, sadhu, shastra. Now it becomes, now we're taking this to court. So what does the shastra say? How can you support this? But in your normal day-to-day activity, that's not an issue. You just assume everyone's speaking from shastra. Right? Yes? Is that okay? Or no?
No, actually, I'm very much confused because I saw some small groups in school. Like small groups, just people doing service together, and some preaching inside, and it's like we follow the Shastra. I can see a lot of people from the school, they're doing different things. As we, if I will tell them, we're doing this, we do. No, it's not the other way around it.
Yeah. Well, that may be more with younger devotees or less experienced devotees, you'll get that. Anyway, that's, like I say, that's where Shastra will come in. Say, okay, I've never heard this before. Where did you hear this? What's the evidence? Then they bring in Shastra, but then they misunderstand it, or they understand it differently.
But how to make clear in this situation? Should I go more deep and look, okay, and go to these people and ask, what are you doing? Can you show me a place? Maybe I should just take some more distance.
Ask this another senior devotee you respect and say, these devotees here say this. Is this true? Is this not? I'm confused. It doesn't sound right. And then he might say, well, what they're saying is not actually right. And then you might have no way of communicating that to them because you have no position. So you just let them say what they say, but inside of you, that there's some few things that they've misunderstood. And you just keep it to yourself. that may be a survival technique within a big organization. Not only what they say, but what they do. Like, you go to temples and people will do things. And you say, that's not right, we shouldn't do that. But you have no control over that. So you just don't do it yourself. Sometimes that's all you can do. Say, well, this isn't... You know, somebody gives a class and he makes so many points. And you come up to me and say, is this your understanding? And I'll say, well, not exactly. I understand his point, but my understanding is a little different. There can be room for both understandings. I prefer this understanding. It makes sense to me. That's what I've understood from Prabhupada. But according to his perspective and his culture, I understand why he's saying this. And they both could work for different people. So sometimes it's like that. They're not both wrong. And sometimes it's like, well, this makes more sense to me. Like you may want to say, in my preaching, I want to do it this way. This is what makes sense, and this is what works for me. I understand the other side, where they wouldn't do that. So they both can be okay, because we're individuals, and what makes sense to you may not make sense to everyone. As long as there's some way it can be related to Shastra and Prabhupada. And if it can't be, then you might bring it up to someone and just say, I think they're wrong, maybe they need to be corrected. When you're a senior devotee, like when you've been around 40 or 50 years, you're going to understand that most devotees don't really understand things that well. They actually have all kinds of misunderstandings that they don't even know they have. And it took you 50 years to realize that 40 years ago you didn't understand half the things you understand now. So that's kind of normal. In other words, some people are going to have limited capacity to understand just based on their level of advancement. They can't understand it any deeper. And also based on their culture. Right? So sometimes you have to see that. So that's why I say, well, what he said is right according to his position and culture and knowledge. So it's right for him, but it's not the complete picture. But he can't understand the complete picture yet because he's only been a devotee 10 years. How would he know these things? And if he hears from superiors, he may spout it off like he knows it, but he doesn't realize it, so it doesn't come out the same. And that's all you can expect. And 20 years from now, he's probably not going to say something different. Yes?
How do you say something like, oh, well, that's just his understanding based on his own advancement, without becoming proud, like, oh, but I understand it better based on my own advancement?
No. And you say, this is my understanding, which maybe it's on a lower level, but it works for me. Or you might say, I had the fortune to hear from some devotees who articulated these points in an extremely broad and balanced way, and I'm just greatly fortunate that I've understood it. So it doesn't become an issue of personal pride, but more an issue of fortune. You know, there's a lot of things that I've understood, but it wasn't my realization. I've understood it because I've heard from other people who deeply realized it. Or it's a topic I've gone into and I've spent months and months studying. And so I had the leisure to do that. And now I think I'd be on. I'm fortunate that I had the time to do that. I could understand it on this level. So we stay humble. We have to. I've taught forgiveness workshops for maybe 8 years or 10 years, and I've studied it deeply. But I still hear things that devotees say about forgiveness realizations that I don't have. So I can't think that, you know, so I kind of think I know the topic because I've studied it more than, I'm sure I've studied it more than anybody except maybe Bhakti Tirthaswami. There are a few people I don't know, but I've studied it in depth more than most devotees. So if someone talks about forgiveness in the class, it's just a fraction of what I've come to realize, but still, I'll hear things. I go, wow, what a deep realization he had. I didn't even have that realization after studying it. So I think we at least have to leave ourselves open. You know, that we may have been fortunate enough to realize something by the grace of some senior devotee or our spiritual master. We don't, you know, and he's, you know, he understands what he understands. You know, like you get a brahmacharya, you give a class on grihastha life. It's going to have limitations. It has to, because of his experience. So you might sit there, you know, and you're married, and And he doesn't know what he's talking about. But you understand he's doing his best. And that's all he can do. So it should make you, hopefully it won't make you proud. It should make you realize that he's got limited capacity. That was what the class was about this morning, right? You don't understand. You understand with your consciousness. It's just information coming. So I think as you get understanding, you should feel gratitude. I'm so fortunate Krishna allowed me to understand this. Or put me in a situation where I was given that knowledge. And if I become proud, he could take it away. Right? That's for sure. They definitely take it away. Like that. It's gone. I don't know. Did you tell me what you said yesterday? I don't know what I said. No, it was really powerful. I have no idea what I said. It's gone. Krishna can do that. And I always personally think that if I think I have some deep realization or deep understanding, I always personally think it's for me. Krishna gave it to me because I needed it, and thank you, Krishna, this is really good. I really try to get it that way rather than think I'm better. And I also think, how do I know what Krishna's giving to somebody else? Just because they don't express it in a class doesn't mean they don't have it. Right? So I'm so useless and rotten and fallen, and Krishna's giving me all these realizations. What is he giving to, like, the devotees who are actually advanced? That's the way you should think. It's just, you know, it's fortune, it's grace. And it's not unique to me. Or it's the holy names giving it to me. It's not coming from me, it's coming from the holy name. And I relish it and I share it. Not out of pride, just to help you and to help myself. That's the proper attitude. But I want to rephrase what I said, because I have seen devotees who are very, very young have very deep realizations. But it fits within their parameters. It may be realizations of book distribution, which is something they've done for the last 3 years. But they have very deep realizations about it. Maybe deeper than I have. So I don't deny that young people can't have deep realizations. They just won't have the full gamut of them that would take years of practice to get. But in specific areas, deity worship books, like they may be doing deity worship for many years. They've been in the movement 10 years. From my point of view, they're young devotees. You know? There's like, they're the age of my children, right? So they're just little kids for me, but they have amazing realization about the deity because that's what they did. But I'm not saying they don't. But I'm just saying, there's certain things, the depth of your understanding will be limited by your advancement, and so if someone doesn't have it, okay. It's a great class, and that's what he understood. And for his level, you know, for the time he's been a devotee, that's good. Yeah. We can still get inspired. If you're in that mood, you can hear better. If you're not in that mood, even if he says something really profound, you won't think it's profound because you've kind of blocked it off. Well, what does he know? And you block yourself up and you don't hear. Yes? Okay, so are we finished? Are we having fun yet? Class has been almost 2 hours. Crazy.
You have more questions?
I think the question you're asking is important because it's common. You're going to go into situations and maybe the devotees aren't acting in ways which you think are 100% proper, or even speaking something philosophically that you think is not 100% proper. It's just their understanding of Krishna consciousness. It's their realization. It's maybe what their guru had told you. You don't know what it is. So sometimes, like I'm saying, you have to just allow them to have their realization And if it doesn't make sense to you, then you live with what you see to be true, and it's okay. I mean, when it becomes a problem is when it's your guru saying that. And you're like a little, you know, that's when it's a little more of a problem. But that does happen also. Because your guru may be emphasizing something. And to you, it just doesn't fit with how you think. So even sometimes that happens. He may be very soft and you're very like a lion. And he preaches very softly and you preach very heavily. And he says, don't preach so heavily. You're blowing people away. No, this is how I preach. It's working. So, you know, sometimes even with your guru, it's like natures are different. It's just a reality you can't avoid. So you have to be able to adjust to all these things without going crazy. It doesn't only have to be just exactly one way. Right? If you just make more room. There's room for different ways of looking at it. You know? No, women should be guru. No, nonsense. Women should be guru. No. Okay. All right. So, is there more than two ways to look at this? Is there, you know? Okay, I understand why some are feeling that way. But what about the other side? And what did Prabhupada say? And you're looking at everything. And so, okay. There's this group you don't agree with. You think, women, none of them should be gurus. They're too emotional. I think they're crazy. How could anybody even dream of the fact that they would be gurus? So that's your opinion, but somebody else has another opinion, so you respect them. Okay? I understand why you would feel they should be. Give them the opportunity. Prabhupada said it. So many women gurus out there today. There can be two opinions. And both can be right. And some opinion is right because it works within a context. And it's wrong 20 years later because the context changes. Because that's what we see happen. Society changes. People change the way they think. What worked 20 years ago doesn't work. Like in the business world, all the people are saying, what worked 20 years ago doesn't work now. Why doesn't it work? Because people don't think the way they do. It worked then because there's a different mentality. Now you have to do it differently. Children are different now. You know, the books about raising children, 1950, may not apply. The kids are so different then. They're so much more obedient and family-centered. There was no divorce. Now the kids are emotional wrecks. So how you deal with them is going to have to be different. Their expectations. Their brains are wired differently because of all the technology they grew up with. So that's why policies change, and that's why, you know, people come up with the latest, newest strategy to do this, because people don't think the way they used to, so it has to align with how they think. So, you know, sometimes I'll see things in this kind of just go, yeah, that's not going to happen 20 years. I just know no one's going to say that 20 years from now. It's just the society has changed so much, and people are too different. It's just not going to make sense to anybody. Now it makes sense, so I just accept it. Okay, this is the way it's going to go. In 20 years, it's not going to go that way. You just know it. So you're okay. Well, if we preached what we preached in the early 70s, a lot of devotees would think it's very fanatic. They had a real hard time. So things have evolved. Okay? Is that okay? Is everybody okay? We're going to end here. It's time for dinner. It's time for breakfast for you. Okay? So, all is well that ends well. We'll see you Wednesday morning. Om Prabhupada Ki Jai.